Welcome to God and Country Radio, a program that discusses current social, political, economic, and prophetic events in the light of biblical theology. I'm your host, Pastor Brad Winship, pastor of Harbor Bible Church in Central New Jersey. This week's program is session number 6 in a series called The Biblical Doctrines of Civil Government. I've had quite a few listeners ask me, "What happened, Pastor Brad? How come you're not addressing the war in Israel, or the new Speaker of the House, or the recent election?" And the reason is that I've preempted all of my regular commentary on the news to create this 13-part series called The Biblical Doctrines of Civil Government, which I plan to package together into a church Sunday school video curriculum so that churches can use these messages to teach this doctrine to their congregations, because the Christian community is woefully uneducated in the biblical role and responsibility of government, which explains why even church-going people can easily be led astray by every wind of doctrine, by the trickery of men, by craftiness and deceitful scheming. Ephesians 4:14. I should be done with this series by January. Then once I'm finished with the workbook, the series will be ready for publication and for use in the churches. Maybe some of you listening today would like to get this material and use it in your church. The whole program is going to be free, and I hope to see it used in thousands of churches. I already have some missionaries in foreign countries who want to use this curriculum to train nationals. And here is something I always forget to mention. If you want to help make this curriculum possible, all of the donations to God and Country Radio over the next 4 months will be going toward the cost of printing the workbooks, the teacher guides, the mailings, etc. I usually don't ask for money, but in this case, since I want to make this curriculum free to the churches, I would like to give listeners the opportunity to be involved in helping in this work. The pen is mightier than the sword. The teaching of truth can change the course of nations. And this curriculum on the biblical doctrines of civil government will have an impact in the grassroots. Politics is downstream from culture, and culture is downstream from the pulpits and the churches. So if you're interested in helping, you can go to our website, godandcountryradio.org, and click on the donate link. And this will make all of the people who pay the bills around here very happy, because they always say, "Pastor Brad, you always forget to ask for donations." Well, this time I didn't forget. Now, in this session, we have finally come to the key text in the New Testament about civil government, Romans chapter 13. The Scottish political historian J.W. Allen stated, "The 13th chapter of the Epistle to the Romans contains what are perhaps the most important words ever written for the history of political thought." Another writer puts it this way: "Romans 13 was and is the most troublesome political passage in the New Testament, and has been responsible for literally millions of words exchanged on the question of political liberty." But however, most Christians, and certainly non-Christians, have never really wrestled with the teachings of Romans 13. Political activists and thinkers, may know about the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the Federalist Papers, but Romans 13 goes unnoticed. And this may be due to the fact that Romans 13 teaches something that both sides of the political aisle don't want to hear. Romans 13:1. "Every person is to be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God." In the early church, Christians might have assumed that since their citizenship is in heaven, that they might have some sort of diplomatic immunity from the Roman state. The Roman government was idolatrous and pagan, and what has righteousness to do with unrighteousness? Plus, look at how the Bible describes the empires of man as cruel beasts in the prophecies of Daniel. And if they're beasts, certainly we're not supposed to submit to them. And if they're bees, certainly they can't be established by God. But notice how all of these assumptions are corrected in Romans chapter 13. It's a crucial chapter for the church to correct so much potential error. At the time this letter was written, Nero, one of the most evil emperors in Roman history, was on the throne, AD 54 to AD 68. And yet Paul writes, every person is to be subject to the governing authorities. For there's no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. I remember also in Paul's day, there were the Jewish zealots who wanted to overthrow Rome. They were the prime example of the opposite teaching of Paul in Romans 13. In fact, in just a few years after the writing of this letter to Rome, the Jewish freedom fighters would inspire the Jews to rebel against Rome, claiming that Rome didn't have the right to occupy the Jewish state. And these zealots were sure that they were following the path of the judges in the book of Judges, those men who are called of God to throw off the control of the invading Midianites and the Philistines. So why not overthrow Rome? So we see that Romans 13 is radical. It's counterculture. It's not the conclusion that the unsaved mind immediately comes to. The opening statement is a command. Every person is to be subject to the governing authorities. The word hupoteso, to be in subjection or submission, is similar to the word obedience. But it carries with it the idea of a hierarchy of authority. And that's the point the apostle goes on to make, that these governing authorities are established by God. And here we have a truth that flies in the face of political philosophers, that God establishes government, not man. Now, there are two points here. First, God works to set up the general institution of government. It wasn't just people sitting around deciding that they need a ruler to help society run better. And second, the individual governments themselves that are in the world have been put there by God. All governments. And that's the point in verse 1. Do you see a government that exists? It's been put there by God. It's not as if there are some governments set up in the world that haven't been put there by God. But most people look to the human circumstances that brought about certain governments, and they fail to see or acknowledge the hand of God's providence. Instead, assuming that if a government exists, it's been put there by man. In our Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson followed the political philosophy of John Locke rather than the words of the Apostle Paul. Our Declaration declares that to secure these rights, governments have been instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Question: do governments derive their intrinsic authority from the consent of the people or from God? That's not some insignificant hair-splitting theological distinction. Because if man is the one who establishes government, then man can overthrow government. As the Declaration of Independence goes on to explain, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it's the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to institute a new government. The rights of resistance, the rights of overthrow, were based on the idea that governments derive their power from the consent of the governed, rather than by the hand of God. And if man can create a government, man can overthrow a government. But Romans 13 teaches people are to be in subjection to government because the governments that exist are established by God, not man. So therefore, if anyone resists government, verse 2, whoever resists the established civil authorities is opposed to God, and those who resist will receive God's condemnation. Then in Romans chapter 13, verses 3 through 4, Paul goes on to give another reason why government should not be opposed, because God sets up the governments that exist for our good. Now let's talk about John Locke, since he was so influential in American political thought. John Locke, 1632 to 1704. He was an English physician and political philosopher, born to a Puritan family, raised in the church. He wrote two treatises on civil government, where he explained his social contract theory of government, where government comes about by men agreeing on a social contract, where the people say, "I will give a king the power of the sword and be under his authority in exchange for his protection of my property." And again, this social contract theory was implied by Jefferson in our Declaration of Independence. And so whenever a government fails to keep the social contract, the people have a duty to overthrow that government. Now, it is true from an earthly point of view, this is the way it looks like some governments have come about, by man's choice. But Locke meant much more than that. He was in effect saying that the authority of government originates from man. Now, Locke would affirm that God gives us our rights, and we should give him credit for that. But he would veer away from Scripture in saying that the authority of government comes from man. All notable Christian theologians have seen the error in Locke's philosophy and in Jefferson's Declaration of Independence. For example, John Murray, the Scottish theologian and one of the founders of Westminster Seminary, in his commentary on Romans 13, writes, "Here it is expressly stated and excludes from the outset every notion to the effect that the authority in the state rests upon agreement on the part of the governed or upon the consent of the governed." Unquote. Now, this doesn't mean that the American Revolution was a complete sin, outside the will of God, but we recognize that the motives in 1776 were a mixed bag. There was theological confusion and humanistic enlightenment influences. Locke today is considered the father of classic liberalism. Even Wikipedia acknowledges that Locke's writings had an influence on the secular atheists of his day, Voltaire, Rousseau. And when Locke came out with his social contract theory, he was hailed a genius. Because starting in the 18th century, any theory that someone could come up with that gave an alternative explanation for some aspect of life that was contrary to the Bible, immediately that philosopher was hailed to be an intellectual social hero. That was the spirit of the age. To give an alternative explanation for sin came Freud. Alternative explanation for origins and cosmology came Darwin. An alternative explanation for politics came Locke. An alternative explanation for economics came Adam Smith. But John Locke was from a Puritan family, and he actually wrote a defense for Christianity called The Reasonableness of Christianity as Delivered in the Scriptures. The error of Locke was an error that many professing evangelicals fall into today. He left the authority of the Bible and began to resort to rationalism, rather than actually wrestling with the Romans 13 text itself. Locke in his treatise superficially concluded that Romans 13 could not mean what it says, because then Christians would have no recourse against tyrants, and that wouldn't be just, and that wouldn't be rational. Locke's explanation for Romans chapter 13 was that Paul was only addressing good government, lawful authority, not evil, unlawful government. And Locke said Paul had a reason for being silent about bad government, because Paul did not want Christians to be seen by the Romans as being subversive. So as far as dealing with evil government, like Rome, Locke said Christians must fill in the silence of Scripture with their own reasoning. So the objections to Romans chapter 13, then and now, are twofold. First, that the text cannot mean all authority is established by God and must be obeyed, because that would substantiate the unpopular medieval teaching called the divine right of kings, that the king's actions are not to be questioned or opposed, for everything he does is ordained by God. And second, Romans 13 is opposed because it seems to be teaching that governments can never be lawfully overthrown. And if that's the case, evil will triumph. Good people would have to live submissively under a totalitarian state. People couldn't better themselves or free themselves. The only thing necessary for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. The only check on evil government is the power of the people to resist. And Romans 13 sounds like it's creating a situation where the people will become doormats for evil rulers. Well, that would all be true, but for the fact that there is a true God in heaven that punishes and removes human rulers and governments. To understand and appreciate Romans 13, one must believe in Jesus Christ's mediatorial rule over the nations. Romans 13, 1, for there's no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Psalm 75, for not from the east, nor from the west, nor from the desert comes exaltation, but God is the judge. He puts down one and he exalts another. Daniel 4:25, the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind, and he bestows it on whomever he wishes. Now, in the process of God taking down evil rulers, only allowing them to rule for a short time, God will sometimes use human agency. Both people working in obedience to God and people working in disobedience to God. There are some allowances for a righteous people to dispose an evil king, as we see throughout the book of Judges. And we'll discuss this in a later session in regard to civil disobedience. But the point in Romans 13 is that God calls the shots, not man. The primary biblical teaching in this regard is laid down for us when King David had the opportunity to take out King Saul. King Saul was a murderer. He murdered all of the priests of Nob. Anyone with a sense of justice knew King Saul had to be judged and taken out. But what does David say to his commander who advised David to assassinate King Saul? 1 Samuel 26. But David said to Abishai, do not destroy him, King Saul, for who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be without guilt? David also said, as the Lord lives, surely the Lord will strike him, or his day will come that he dies, or he will go down into battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. Well, the point is, the removal of the king is God's prerogative, and God could use many different agencies, but it's not to be by the hand of God's people. Because Romans 13, governing authorities are established by God, therefore whoever resists has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. Now, one of the ways people try to get around the meaning of Romans 13 is to take the phrase, those which exist are established by God, and qualify it or limit it by the phrase in verse 4, it's a minister of God to you for good. Therefore, only governments that are ministers for good are ordained by God. And therefore, we can disobey and overthrow governments that we believe are not ministers for good. This is a very common interpretation that you'll find in some evangelical commentaries by men who don't understand how God could ordain and establish evil government and how we could possibly be called to obey it. But textually, Romans 13:4 is not qualifying or limiting the ruling authorities in verse 1. The qualifier of governmental authorities is right in verse 1. All governments that exist are ordained of God. Does it exist? Then it's established by God. What verse 4 is teaching is that all governments, even evil governments, are still for our good. One thing we know for sure that backs up this obvious interpretation of Romans 13 is that throughout the Bible, God tells us that he allows for and ordains evil governments to arise. Romans 9:17, quoting Exodus chapter 9, for the scriptures say to Pharaoh, for this very purpose I raised you up, to demonstrate my power in you. God raised up the evil Pharaoh in the Exodus. Concerning foreign governments that invaded and occupied Israel, Judges chapter 3, God sold them into the hands of the kings of Mesopotamia. Judges 3:12, the Lord strengthened Eglon the king of Moab against Israel. Judges 7:1, the Lord gave them into the hands of the Midianites. In Judges chapter 10, the Lord sold them into the hands of the Philistines. And King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon was no saint, but the prophet Jeremiah told the people, Jeremiah 27, now I have given all these lands into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, my servant. All nations shall serve him and his son and his grandson until the time of his own land comes. Zechariah chapter 11. God says to the prophet, take again for yourself the equipment of a foolish shepherd. For behold, I am going to raise up a shepherd in the land who will not care for the perishing, seek the scattered, heal the broken, or sustain the one standing. The shepherd there is a reference to governmental leaders. Did God raise up Pilate? You know, Pilate thought he was operating independently of God. Pilate thought he had in his hand the power of life and death. But Jesus said to Pilate, you would have no authority over me unless it has been given to you from above. It is clear that Romans chapter 13 is teaching God establishes all government, even evil government, to which we must submit. Not that we participate in the evils of such government, but we bear the punishment. Did God raise up Hitler and Stalin? That's a controversial question, but he did. A civil leader can only come to power by the providence of God. And this is where a lot of people have a problem with this doctrine. So they can't receive Romans chapter 13. So they won't receive the teaching. So they won't receive what Romans 13 is teaching. Even the prophet Habakkuk couldn't understand how God could use the wicked nation of Babylon to judge Israel. There's Habakkuk's famous statement in chapter 1. Yes, Lord, you've established them to judge us, but how can you look upon wickedness with favor? How can you use wicked people? Well, it's quite simple. God uses evil people to judge other evil people. If a people don't love righteousness and serve God, they will learn by having to serve the devil. Now, in Romans chapter 13, verse 4, Paul gives that second reason as to why we should submit ourselves to civil authorities. Remember, the first reason in verse 1 is because they're established by God. The second reason is that they are ministers of God to you for good. Notice that the text does not say that all governments are morally good, but that all governments are for your good. That might seem like a distinction without a difference, but that is a valid biblical distinction. Coming from Genesis chapter 50, verse 11, where Joseph said to his brothers, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. The action of Joseph's brothers selling him into slavery was a heinous evil, but God was going to use that evil for the good of Joseph and his people. Evil government will test our faith and our obedience. It will correct our priorities. It will humble and punish even evildoers, and it will give us an opportunity to witness for Christ. As Paul writes in Philippians chapter 1, that by being arrested, Paul was able to witness to the entire Praetorian Guard. The bottom line is we just don't understand biblically what we need and what is good. And that's why Romans 13 is not readily received by many. To believe the teaching of Romans 13, one has to have a genuine belief and trust in God that he rules over the nations. You've been listening to God and Country Radio, the radio website to listen to this program again or other past programs. And the series is godandcountryradio.org. The YouTube and Rumble channel is God and Country Biblical Exposition. Thanks for listening. Stand firm in the faith. And may Jesus Christ reign.